ready. Get ready. It's time for the Medicare Fun Cast. Medicare information for those that need it. Music, memories, interviews, and pop culture for those that don't. And now, here's Brian Kulis.
All right, there I am. I'm so excited. We got a special guest with us today on the Medicare Fun Cast. I'm Brian Kulis. And I want to give special thanks to Doc Washburn of The Doc Washburn Show. We're on his network. He's political commentary, unmasked, unfiltered, uncensored. Got to check out his show. And also Donnie Copeland with Red Pill Sports, Sports Done Right. And I'll tell you what, if you love music like I do, raise my hand here. You're going to love this next person I'm going to bring up in just a second. And, of course, on the second part of the show, we do talk about Medicare. I'm going to talk about Medicare special enrollment. So if you have questions about when you can enroll, different times during the year, what they mean, hang around for this. And I want to introduce a friend of mine, Denny Tedesco. Denny, it's great to see you.
It's seeing you, Brian. It's been a while.
Awesome. Are you in Burbank right now? Where are you at?
No, I'm in Woodland Hills.
Woodland Hills, okay.
Awesome. Still the valley in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. And a lot of people are going to know you. You've had two movies come out here in the last, 10 years or so. I think, what was it, Wrecking Crew in 2015, was it?
Yeah. Is that when that came out? Finally came out, yeah.
And Immediate Family, which is your latest movie. And I guess what I want to talk about, tell people a little bit about you, your background. You're incredibly famous father, and how your first movie came about, The Wrecking Crew. And we're not talking about the Wrecking Crew with Dean Martin, right?
It's funny you say that. My father, who was a studio musician, actually played on that movie.
Oh, that's hilarious. That is so funny.
It's funny because before I start, I tell them when I was trying to get, I'll get to that. So my dad, Tommy Tedesco, was a studio guitarist in Los Angeles. And my parents came out of Niagara Falls, New York in 1953, came to LA thinking that, you can make money playing guitar. And my dad got hooked up into the studios. And so the late 50s, in the early 60s, he got really embedded in the whole scene here. And in the early 60s, he was doing all the Phil Spector stuff. He was doing the Beach Boys. And in the 60s, what happened was the rock and roll started taking over. And the labels didn't really trust the bands in those days. Spending money in the studios, you didn't trust people going in because it's going to take them a while to record.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
So right. They would put session guys in that could do the tracks, and then you put the vocals over it. So my dad was one of those guys. And in the 60s, they did the Beach Boys, Sinatra, Janet Dean, Mamas and Papas, Fifth Dimension, Sam Cooke, the Birds, Nancy Sinatra, Monkees. Anything that was done in the 60s in L.A. most likely had a group of these guys, if not one or two of them, if not all. And they were called the Wrecking Crew later because they said, these guys are going to wreck the business, play the rock and roll. Because the older guys didn't like the fact that these guys were doing this rock and roll stuff.
Yeah, because a lot of the older musicians were kind of like maybe like the jazz guys or the big band type of musicians, right?
Yeah, I don't want to say legit. They were legit, the guys that were making the money in the studios, the movies. They were doing the Dean Martins and the Sinatras, but before our guys jumped in. And then once these guys got embedded into this, and they're making all these hits, it's like everybody wanted to go doing the rock and roll. But by then the chairs were already taken.
Oh yeah. And those chairs were dear. How many songs, movie soundtracks and everything did your father play on?
Oh God, probably thousands.
Oh, that's amazing.
I say that the only reason is because he was working all the time. He would go, the deal, what the studios or the union said, hey, you go in for 3 hours, you can only do three or four songs in 3 hours. That was all they wanted you to do.
Right.
So dad was working 12 hours a day for years. So you're figuring you do at least three songs, whatever, and you're knocking them out, boom, boom. No, you know, doesn't mean they're all hits, you know. And then he went into filming movies for many years, for 20 years. He was constantly working. His longevity in his career was because he could read music and fabulous gut string player. You know, he could play all the different instruments. He could play the bouzoukis or the mandolins and the electrics and all that. You know,
and there's a great part of the movie where didn't they turn the music upside down and he's looking at it playing the music while it's upside
down. That was
what
Glenn Campbell told that story to me. He goes, there was a time they were doing a Jan and Dean date. He goes, and your father stood up. He goes, started walking towards the music, and Jan got really pissy. He was like, guys, we gotta go. Tommy, sit down. And if you knew my father, it's like, if you yell at him like that, okay, I'll sit down. And he starts playing the music, and then they stop and yell, Tommy, what are you playing? I'm just playing what's there. And Jan, comes around, and he goes, it's upside down. Well, he's trying to turn it up, but he could play upside. He could play. That's how he learned how to read music.
Wow.
Because in the 50s, don't forget, you think about it's sheet music. You had to spend money. They didn't have any money. So if he had sheet music, it could be a standard. Let's say God Bless Your Child or whatever the standard is. He'd flip it upside down. It's a different song now going the other way.
Oh, that's hilarious.
And he would just, and people say, how did you learn how to read? He goes, no different than the English language. If you see the 100 times, that's the. If you see the notes, the C note, and it's in that position, you know where that is.
That's true. It absolutely.
Sounds easier than it is. And by the way, I don't play an instrument, so I didn't practice.
You have other talents, absolutely.
I hope so.
And, that was the days in the 60s and things before pagers and the internet. And we have, our iPhone. So basically, was he at beck and call? Like if Brian Wilson, the Beach Boys, wanted him at 2 in the morning, did they just call your house?
That's a really good question, Brian. No one's ever asked that. It's very funny. So what you did is they had these answering services that were kind of like keyed for the musicians. They all joined the same ones.
Yes.
One of them was called Arlen's. One of them was called Hotline, Your Girl Friday. And there was like three of them. And they were actually, some of these studios would have literally direct lines to them. So in between the breaks, you would check your answering service. You constantly check. You call, hey, this is Tommy, and he calls. And this was a work habit, which is extraordinary because you could pick up a call later in the day. Hey, let me get back to you. And he calls up the service. Boom. Hey, you got something for the Beach Boys later. Can you do it? Yep, I'm there. It was like,
wow.
It was run and gun at home. So let's say Hollywood's 30 minutes away from Northridge where we grew up.
Yes.
With a running line. He'd come home, get into the house. He'd say, any calls? We knew what he meant. Did the service call? And even if he didn't, even if they didn't call, he'd still check with them. It was a work ethic that I got to say, it's really hard to teach work ethic today.
It sure is.
You know what I mean? And it's just the way it is.
Right.
And there are, when we were in the late 60s, early 70s, we had four lines in our house. We had 886-1333, 886-1338. And it was 334. And the reason was he had a rotary system in there. There was never going to be a busy signal in that house if one of us kids picked up the phone and started talking to their friends.
Oh, right. Yes, absolutely.
Because that made the difference. Because, hey, if I call Brian up or Tommy up and he says, hey, and he's busy, it's a busy signal, I call the next guy to see because I need to find someone tomorrow.
Yeah, especially in Brian Wilson is an urgent need to create something at 2 in the morning,
And you didn't want to, you realize as a freelancer, anybody that's a freelancer, as many of us are in our lives, one moment of meeting someone changes your life.
Absolutely,
It can change your payroll for the next 10 years. You lose an account, or you gain an account. And that's how it was, When we went on vacations, you ask one little question, see what you get, Brian.
But I love it. This is great
when
stuff.
When we went on vacations, my father would tell the answering service, he would never tell them we were on vacation. He says, I'm not available the first 2 weeks or whatever. Because if they called, he said, no, the answering service would say, well, he's not available those dates. Because it looks like Tommy's working all the time.
Absolutely, yes. Was.
But, you know, there was another, it's like me checking the book. Let me see if I'm busy and check the book. Available.
Yeah, there you go. And you know, at home, you know, somebody that works at McDonald's and cooks burgers all day, when they get home, they may not necessarily want to grill burgers for their family. Did your dad take his work home with him? Did he still play guitar around the house, or did he just want to chill out, do something else?
Dad, it's funny because I'm born in 61, so I'm almost 63, and I didn't see my father play an instrument until probably at home until 76, 77. Truly play his instrument, because that's when he started a jazz album that he wanted to do, and he started practicing. He never had a practice going to work. He had in his car, he had like 5 or 6 instruments, never took them out of his trunk, which would horrify guitar players today because of
right.
Mm-hmm. But you know, he went in, he had a mandolin maybe, or he had his acoustic, mm-hmm. he'd have his gut string, he'd have his Telecaster and amp, maybe a 12 string, and he'd have these things in the car. And then if they asked for something else, but he was going to work 12, 14 hours. He come home, he did not, you know, it was either watching TV, you know, with the kids or himself playing cards. I never saw him. It's funny because everybody thinks it's a hootenanny with us. There was never music. He didn't turn on music. If I was in the car, I don't think he turned on music. I think it was the baseball game. Do you know what I mean? It just was like, I got to clear my head, you know.
You'd decompress or whatever.
Yeah, I never, yeah. You know, it's from then we didn't think about it. It only came to me years later.
And it's like, you know, many children of famous people, it's your father, it's your mother, you know, you don't really think about someone that's super famous or hanging out with all these famous people. He's your father. So, you know, he comes home, he's your dad. So,
yeah. And again, he was famous among the musicians and the artists. He wasn't famous to the public.
Because yeah, walking around the street, he's not
in the 60s,
right.
Especially the 60s. You know, they never got credits on the albums because a lot of times they didn't want to give credits to these guys, you know, because it was like this, they were doing Pet Sounds. They were doing the other Beach Boy albums maybe at the same time they were doing Sinatra, the maybe the Birds or something, or Association. They didn't want to let folks know that it wasn't those guys playing.
Like the Monkees and everything.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's funny, the Monkees got all the grief, but everybody else was doing the same thing. You still had Mick Dolenz singing, but you know, they got the grief.
And growing up, did your father have any famous friends that hung around your house? Or I mean, was like you said, he kind of would deal with these famous people at work, and then the rest of the time he's just
normal. It's really funny because we'll talk about it later when we get into the next doc. That's the difference. His dad went to work for 3 hours. Mm-hmm. He might have a session at 9 o'clock to 12, and then he's got a 1 o'clock with maybe another group. He might be with Herb Alpert in the morning, and then Sinatra later, or so and so later, or nobody later. So they're moving so fast; they're not going on the road with these guys. They're not hanging out
because they would lose money on the road, right? They made more money doing session work.
Yeah, you didn't. If you left town, that meant you weren't really working a lot.
And you may lose your position there.
Exactly.
In the studio,
absolutely. Right. You did not give up your chair unless you had to. Or like Glenn Campbell gave up, you know, walked away for, I think, a few months to do the Beach Boys. But, you know, Glenn's making a lot of money on the road with the Beach Boys. And he can come back because it's Glenn.
Because it's Glenn, yes, absolutely.
You know, he's got his thing.
Yeah, Brian, that's when Brian Wilson stopped touring. And Glenn just filled in there. on the bass and was tall and handsome guy and fit right in. So, And your dad, Tommy also did, the theme to Bonanza and some of the TV shows we all love.
So Dad did a lot of theme work and a lot of TV and film because he's one of the few guys, not one of the few guys, but he was an extraordinary reader. Not that Batman's a hard part to play, but he was known for his reading capability and being able to do multi-instruments. So he did Bonanza, Batman, Green Acres was yes. actually one of the first, the only times or the first time I ever went to the studio with him as a kid. And the only reason we went is we were going on vacation after that session. It was a set session that Vic Mizzi, the conductor, writer, yes. had every Monday. And we went after that, we left town. So that's why we were with him. And I still, the reason I always remembered it, because I saw this man, Vic Mizzi, doing this. You know, he's conducting. And it was the funniest thing to a five-year-old. And so it always sat with me, not knowing he was one of the great composers of our time. And, but yeah, he was able, then, you know, Green Acres, you know, or like I said, Green Acres, but then he did in the 70s, Three's Company, that awful wow.
Oh, I didn't know he did that. Yes.
And then wow.
Right.
Awful. And, but, you know, he did it. And, but, you know, he's known for his acoustic work. And he really got to show that off in movies with James Horner and John Williams.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. So that came in later.
Well, Denny, let's play the Wrecking Crew promo, kind of whet everyone's appetite about the Wrecking sure. Crew.
When we're ready to sing, we step up at the microphones, and it comes out something like this.
We came in the studios with Levi's and T-shirts, smoking cigarettes. The older guys were saying they're going to wreck the music business.
In the hardcore producing area, everybody knew what went on there. I mean, everybody knew that the best musicians played in all the sessions, but we as the general public didn't know.
They played so well, and they played so well together.
I was in awe of them because of Phil Spector. I pulled my car over the side of the road and said, what am I listening to here?
The musicians were really the unsung heroes of all those hit records.
When I listen to the record, it is so apparent that these guys were just really so good. And you can see why everybody used them.
The Wrecking Crew was the focal point of the music. They were the ones with all the spirit and all the know-how.
We made up a lot of arrangements ourselves.
We would either augment or totally replace a group.
The public was oblivious that there was this secret star maker machinery.
I had no idea that people didn't play their own records until the Monkees came along.
We were so busy.
I was making more money than the president of the United States.
7 records of the year.
It was unbelievable.
Here's the way that the beat goes on sounded when we first heard it. La-di-da-da-da. Yeah, I said, uh-oh. The third line I came up with was...
The beat goes on.
They were the stone-cold rock and roll professionals, and there may never be a group of that caliber again.
Wow, that's terrific, Denny. And I've got this shirt here on that that you gave me a couple years ago. I love it. So
it's funny. I haven't seen that in so long, and I still move to it, so I'm happy about that.
And the best place to get the DVD, is it WreckingCrewFilm.com? Is that the best website?
Yeah, and if you say thank you on the discount code, you get a discount on anything.
Oh, excellent.
And if people still have DVD players, the other thing is you could probably watch it on Hulu, or you could probably, I think it's on Amazon Prime as well, but I know you could watch it on Hulu right now.
Yeah, it's on Amazon. I checked that a couple minutes ago. But it's worth watching. And any closing thoughts on the Wrecking Crew, and we're going to segue over to your latest.
No, endeavor. I mean it's funny, you know, like watching that. And you, as you remember, that film I started in '96 when my dad was passing away.
Okay,
you know, I wanted to tell that story. He was, you know, he had cancer, and I didn't have much time to tell it. You know, I was like, oh, I better jump on this. And I think I didn't want to have any regrets in my life. that would have been a big regret. I should have done this.
Yes.
And it took 19 years to make. And the reason was it took 12 years to finally cut a film. And it was my wife was the one that said, we just made the most expensive movie ever. And we have nothing to show for it. And I describe it as having a property overlooking the beach. And yes. You can have these beautiful piece of land. You have the plans to build a house. You have the appliances waiting. But until you build it, you can't sell it. So at that point, we basically, you know, did everything not you're supposed to do, and what you're not supposed to do, which is credit cards and all the refinancing. And I made a movie. And once I got the movie into festivals, it did extremely well.
Yes.
And then it was like, now what? I have $500,000 to pay off for the licensing of this music. You can't.
Well, the music licensing was huge, right?
Huge. There's 110 songs in that film, and you'll know 105 probably. And so I basically created ways of raising the next $500,000 over the next 5 years. And it was crowdfunding. It was everything but a bake sale.
You know, sales, huh?
Yeah. But even like, you know, we did it together. You know, you brought me out, you know, we showed the film to potential insurance folks, you know, and that's how right. I don't know what you would call it, an incentive for you guys. But it was fun because I get to show it to people that have no idea. And
people love doing the meet and greet with you. They get
it's the best part. Okay. So someone says, "Don't you get tired of it?" I said, No. I love talking to people, and I love showing it because it's the first time they've seen it, and they're going.
It is, and this is music. I mean, even I recently went to the Ringo Starr concert in Little Rock, and you know, there's 8-year-olds there. There's people in their 50s. There's 60, like I'm almost 60, and people in their 80s. And this music just lives on. And I was in a restaurant the other day, David's Burgers here in Little Rock, and they always play great music on the intercom. And I was sitting there counting. There was like 8 of the 10 songs your dad had played on.
Yeah.
It was just amazing. It was all
crazy.
Good it is. And the children now, they're getting tired of the, I don't know what you'd call it, just the junk out there, I guess. Some of the top 40 stuff and the auto tune and everything, and it's not natural. You know, anybody could put their voice through auto tune and make them sound halfway good.
It's funny. They came up the other day at a dinner with a bunch of musicians. I said, "Does that mean I could actually do an album?"
What'd they say?
I'm not going to diss auto tune yet.
Okay. All right.
But it's amazing though. Working, you know, being around these musicians myself. And watching them go into the studios. Don't forget, these studio musicians, they didn't have any time. They didn't know what the music was. I got off the phone with Steve Lukather of Toto about an hour ago because we're talking about some project.
And, oh, how cool.
And the idea of you're going in, you get a piece of paper, you sit there, go, yep, okay.
Blah, 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 blah. Oh, yeah.
And you do put your heart, you're not reading music, you're making music. You have a guide to go with, and then you got to make it. And they're in like auto tune. They didn't have that luxury. You were out of tune. Okay, let's do it again. You know, and that's how they did it. Glenn Campbell, who was one of the Wrecking Crew members, and Leon Russell, who was a Wrecking Crew member, Glenn said it was like playing with Michael Jordan. He goes, everybody in the room was a Michael Jordan because you couldn't just pop in on bar 32 if you made a mistake. You had to go back to one and start all over. So you got to get that out. Don't forget, everybody's got another gig in 4 hours. So let's figure this out.
That's right. Yeah, time is money, and get it knocked out. And I mean, like with Ringo Starr, the musicians there, you had Edgar Winter, who just blew me away at almost 80 or early 80s, whatever age he is. Ringo looks great. You had Colin Hay from Men at Work, and all these great songs, and. I love it because everyone's a senior citizen, but those grandpas can rock.
That's really interesting you said that, because that was one of the reasons when I think in part of me, in my heart, when Dad was 60,
yes,
he was an amazing, killer guitar player. I mean, mm-hmm. people look on the internet, you know, you go look up him playing, you go, oh my God, he's a monster. He was a monster on his instrument. At 62, you know, he's working, but not that much. Right. Because at this point, the new, you know, new generation's coming in. So now he's getting calls for like Godfather 3 or Schindler's List, things that they want him for. They want only, you know, they don't need him for rock and roll. They're not going to bring him in. And new era come in. But it was frustrating for me because I hear all this stuff on the radio go, oh God, he's so much better than what they're playing right now in the smooth jazz. And right. he didn't care. He was loving where he was. But then he had a stroke at 62. Mm-hmm. And that ended his career. And I think part of me was this thing about making this film was like saying, there's no age on creativity. Don Randy's 85, 86 right now, and he's playing the club every month at the Baked Potato. Great. And he kills it. Like you said, the Ringo, those good. It's not like, oh, it's a bunch of old guys playing and, oh, don't they sound cute? Oh, my God, you should be able to sound so good.
Ringo's all-star band was tight. I mean, just amazing. And
that's a special. What I'm saying is, my father said to the kids in these seminars, he said, listen, mm-hmm. when you took up an instrument, you took it up because you love it. And he goes, if you make a living, if you make some money, great. If you make a living at it, amazing. But don't ever quit. You know, and I have so many friends that are in their 60s now that are playing that went back to or took the instrument up that never played before. And that's
terrific. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what the greatest thing is about, you know, music. It's never too late. That's what I'm hoping for me. I say that now, but I still haven't figured out the third chord yet.
Well, when's your double LP coming out next year?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
Let me just do vocal.
Just vocal. Okay. There you go.
And a rain stick.
Well, let's segue to the immediate family. And sure. Let's play the trailer here. So we'll see what this is about and we'll talk about it.
Okay. In the early 70s, you couldn't pick up an album and look at the liner notes without seeing these guys' names.
I would buy records just because they were on it.
The creative input of these session guys cannot be overstated. It can't be overstated.
Russ Kunkel.
Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain.
Danny Kortchmar.
And it's too late, baby, now it's too late.
Lee Sklar. Waddy.
They were just musicians we knew, and they gradually became legendary session musicians.
My main goal is to not get fired.
Tapestry, the whole thing was done in 3 weeks.
Three songs in one day, and we didn't piece together the best.
No, like it wasn't overdub.
Look, we were all in our 20s. Now, there was no sleeping.
Each album became like a, what's the next thing they're gonna do?
Not only did they give birth to this music, they're as much the author of these songs as the artist they did it with.
Ego goes out the window.
Well, I'm not sure that's true. I have a huge ego.
Well,
you can walk across the water.
I could get hipper, younger people.
In this hotel.
Yeah. But these are the people that play it best.
All I can express is admiration for these guys.
Four truly great players, all of them masters of their instrument.
In hindsight, I was just happy to be there.
I've got a band full of brothers that love me. I'm proud of all of it.
Oh, that's great, Danny. I've watched that a couple months ago, and just a fantastic follow-up to The Wrecking Crew. And you're a couple years older than me, so, you know, in the 70s and 80s, that's a lot of the music that we grew up with and we relate to. So
it's really interesting. So what happened here was the Wrecking Crew came out, if you remember, in 2015. And I think, like I said, I was pretty shell-shocked, you know, and after 19 years of making the first doc. So finally, someone came up with an idea that had some financing. You know, everybody has great ideas, but until you get the money, it doesn't mean much.
Yes.
And it was actually, someone came up with it and said, hey, would you be interested in this doc and da-da-da? And they went to the artist, and the artist said, well, you know what? We have our own director. We'd like him to do it. So, no, it was no, I don't care. That's fine. It was just nice to be considered. But in that, the producers said, oh, they were bummed. And they said, well, what about this idea? And I said, now that's mine. Totally got it. I knew these guys, legends. You know, I didn't know them personally. Leland Sklar I knew because he'd been around during the Wrecking Crew era in terms of helping, you know, always supportive. But these other guys, the names I knew. They were, you know, I grew up like you did, looking at the credits or the liner.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
And Cooch, you know, I always kid, I said, everybody, all these names were kind of odd. Leland Sklar, Cooch,
right.
Waddy, you know, and Russ Kunkel. Of course, he's a drummer. It sounds like a drum, Kunkel. You know what I mean? There's something about it. So when I went and pitched the guys, they had this band called Immediate Family, you know, their own little band. And I say little band because, you know, it's small label and they're just doing it. You know, they're not giving up their careers as session guys. And Waddy still goes out on the road with Stevie Nicks as her MD. And Russ and Leland are still on the road with Lyle Lovett. So, but in between, they want to play. So this band. So I thought, there's my hook. I said, there's these guys in their 70s that are brothers. They call themselves the Immediate Family for that reason. And I said, it's the perfect segue from the Wrecking Crew in two ways. I said, at the beginning of the Wrecking Crew, I said, this is the story of my father and his extended family, the Wrecking Crew. But they were family. Dad went to work like many people with their occupations. Sometimes you spend way more time with your work colleagues than your own family for many years. That's the way it is as people that have careers. And then the other thing was, in the end of Wrecking Crew, I went to Lou Adler, who had produced the Mamas and Papas and Jan and Dean. I said, when you did Tapestry, you know, Carole King's Tapestry in 71, did you change your sound and get new guys and da-da-da-da? He goes, absolutely not. He said, Carole King brought her own guys in. She brought in her friends, Cooch, and she brought in James Taylor. So it was like Dad from heaven's going, all right, this is what you got to do. And it was like, and I pitched the guys the idea. Next day they said, yes, we're in. And Carole King can be interviewed in 3 weeks. And went, oh my God.
Wow.
It's like 3 weeks. I'm like,
wow.
Do I really know this? You know, it sounds like I know the story, but there's a lot more to it when you're doing a project like this. So I started, you know, reading as much as I could, starting to listen to all those albums again and quickly, you know, and I, you know, learned on the job as I was going, because, you know, that's 40 years ago. I don't remember that. 50 years ago.
Yeah, it's 50 now.
I'm only a teenager at that point. All I'm coming from is a son of a musician. I understand what they're going through. I understand the elements they were dealing with. I understand the politics. I understand insecurities. I understand all that.
Yes. And that album still comes up on many, many times as one of the top 10 or top 5 albums of all time. I mean,
absolutely. That was one of the things, you know, the greatest thing is it's all about these singer-songwriters, a lot of these artists we interviewed. I can't hear a lyric to save my life, you know, which is something in my brain just doesn't work. Mm-hmm. I can hear a guitar solo or a bass lick. I can hear a guitar ripping in the background, but I can't tell you what the song is about. So yes, I know Danny Kochmar's, you know, I can scat along Danny's, you know, solo on It's Too Late. So
now you meet so many celebrities, you know, a lot of famous people and things. Was there somebody during the Wrecking Crew or Immediate Family that you were just kind of awestruck meeting? Was there somebody like that?
Yeah. You know what? It's funny. I think you get awestruck immediately, but it goes away. awesome, yes, very quickly, because you start asking them questions they've never been asked. Do you know what I mean? Because I've done a lot of interviews with people like actors and, you know, over the years on my other, you know, projects and stuff. And they're always, I'm always there. We're selling a movie. We're selling an album. We're selling something, a product, you know, so there's always something that's behind it. But when I do with these folks, they're getting to answer questions. Like Glenn Campbell is a perfect example. I'm not talking to Glenn in those days about how he became famous, you know, and da 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 da. I'm talking about the early days and how special it was for him. And he was really thrilled about that. He was willing to talk. He'd love to. Same thing with Leon Russell. Leon wanted, you know, I'm not bringing up things that they've done hundreds of times. But no, I mean, I'm always awestruck. I mean, Linda Ronstadt, when I saw her walk in, or James Taylor and Carole King, I mean, there was something about them that maybe because it was closer to me, but or Jackson Brown, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, I had the greatest moment I had in the last 6 months is Jackson called me. You know, he had a question or he wanted to compliment the film and da da da. And he goes, "Hey, Denny, it's Jackson Brown." And I went, "Oh." You don't want to be an idiot and geek, you know. Hi, Jackson.
Yes. And but, so the immediate family, you're you know, the singer-songwriters come in through the 70s, and you even go into, you know, the 80s. You've got Phil Collins in there and
Don Henley.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Don Henley.
Yeah, because that was... And what happened, so let me explain the immediate family, why they're different than the Wrecking Crew. Mm-hmm. We kind of mentioned it earlier. The Wrecking Crew had these 3-hour sessions, and it was like labels hired them because they didn't really trust the bands. So they're boom, 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 boom.
Right.
And then they, you know, get a road band, go on the road. And the road bands only had to learn 10, 12 songs. So it wasn't a big deal. You know, so people said, how did they do it if they didn't play on the album? They had weeks to rehearse. Well, what's going on now is 1971, 72, they're doing Sweet Baby James, you know, with James Taylor.
Yes.
And they do the album. That takes probably a month. They're taking their time. And these guys are involved in making the album. They're not just, there's the charts and they're going to do it. They're having suggestions. Well, what if I do this? Da, da, da. And they, not that the Wrecking Crew didn't do that, but don't forget the Wrecking Crew only did it within 3 hours.
That's right. Boom, I mean, boom, boom. Right.
These guys are doing, taking their time. So they're now, they do an album. Then Peter Asher, who produced it, says, let's go on the road, and takes those guys on the road. So they support the album they just recorded. So that's how all that goes down. So they get on the road, and Leland actually goes, that's his first gig, his Sweet Baby James tour, not the album, tour. He leaves college for a month. Oh. They find him, they said, and they offered him the job. So he goes on the road. He says, yeah, I'll get out of, you know, I'll leave school for a month, come back. Went back 55 never years later.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah. And I remember in the Wrecking Crew, I'm not sure if it was a musician with Gary Lewis and the Playboys, but they heard the studio musicians doing his part, you know, that he's going to have to play on the road. I think it might have been Gary Lewis, Playboys.
No, it was Tommy Tripperhorn.
Right. And he says, like, how in the world, you know, I can't do this on the road, you know? Can you teach me this?
That was a sure, she's sure going to love you, or she's going to love you.
Right.
Gary Lewis thing. And I remember Tommy Tripperhorn, who's actually, his daughter, the actress, went blank. He was a great guitar player, but he didn't, you know, what my dad is brought in, he sits down, he does his gut string, you know,
yes,
he just whips across the fretboard, he gives his, you know, the taste of this and that. Well, not everybody can do that. That's his thing. And he said, the first time I heard it, he goes, it was on the Mike Douglas show, and we're doing playback, we're not even playing live, and all of a sudden he hears that come across, went, oh my god, how am I gonna, I can't even pretend to do that.
That's terrific. Yeah. And immediate family, what is maybe one moment from the movie that people are just gonna look at and go, wow, that song means so much to me, or maybe like the highlight of the movie.
I think that's like saying, what's your favorite child?
That's true,
which,
right?
Yeah, which, you know, my parents, I was their favorite child, but that's another story.
Oh, of course, right, yes.
See, I wouldn't go for my children. I didn't want them to hear this. I think it's funny about these films. What's so great is every song is a bookmark in someone's life. Linda Ronstadt, you know, I think some of my favorite, there's one of my favorite stories about Linda Ronstadt is when Waddy is on the road with her and she goes, and she calls up Waddy, goes, where are the guys? And he goes, they went to a strip joint across the street. She goes, I want to go. He goes, really? He goes, yeah. And she goes, yeah. Okay. So he goes crossing a major highway, getting across there. They get to the door. It's a dive, you know, strip joint. And can you imagine? And the lady at the door says, you have ID? And she goes, and Linda goes, I don't have ID. And you got to have ID. And Wani goes, it's Linda Ronstadt. You still have ID. And he goes, and so Wani turns to her and says, sing something. And she goes, she starts singing Blue Bayou. And
oh, no.
And then Bayou goes, fine, go and.
Yeah. Oh, no.
Yeah. The stories are, again, you asked me, did my father ever become close to any of the artists? No, not really. They had respect of the artists and they could see each other and talk to each other and, you know, like, you know, friends, but not like what the media family had, because they were on the road for months at a time, for years at a time. So
right,
their
absolutely.
Kids are the same age when they're going out. They're all in their late 70s now, but they're in their 20s, having a great old time doing road work. And that's how they bond, you know. James Taylor and Danny Kochmar go back to when they're 13 and 15, when they're kids in the Cape. So that's where their relationship starts.
Oh, speaking of Waddy, you sent me over this outtake. This is a funny story. And I love Waddy. I'd love to meet him someday. Yeah. He's hilarious. Here's a clip.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was on the way home from the session or something, and I was out of cigarettes, and I went into the 7-Eleven, and I reached in my pocket. I didn't have any money. And Lonely Boy was playing on the radio. And I'm looking at this guy behind the counter. I'm going, gee, I wonder if I tell the guy that it's me soloing there, if he'll give me a cigarette, you know. I didn't do it. I just didn't have the nerve to do it. So I just kind of walked out like the little chump that I am. But, you know, it did cross my mind.
Oh, I love that song, Growing Up in the 70s. Yeah, that's hilarious. You know,
it's funny because a lot of these songs, even though I grew up with them, some of them I didn't really get into.
Right.
And it just wasn't when I wasn't paying attention. I was into a whole different thing. I might have been in Earth, Wind & Fire or whatever I was into. And when I heard this and I started hearing Waddy's solos, I go, oh, my God. Because it was like new to me. Even though I knew the song, I didn't pay attention. So I get excited. I was so excited making this film because I got to relive some of this stuff and learn. And the other thing that we had is albums. You know, oh, what's on, you know, picking out music, go, oh, what's this on number 8 on the B side? And I'm listening to it, go, wow, I've never heard this before. And figure out a way to put it into a movie.
And that's what we miss. You know, we grew up with, and I guess LPs are coming back in some way with the younger generation. But I remember going to the store, you buy your LP, you sit there in your bed, in your bedroom, and look through all the liner notes. And it was a bonus if they had lyrics and everything, which was always cool. And you looked at the art, and you looked at the, you know, there was so much great information. It was just like a little novel in this LP.
Yeah.
And so many great songs. Like you said, the B-sides, too, were fantastic.
Yeah, and FM radio changed everything. You know, that's something that's not in the movie, but we talked about. You can't put everything in the movie, but FM and LPs came at the same time, late 60s, meaning like, you know, they had LPs for a long time, but in pop music like this. And FM was able to play longer cuts. they had more leeway in terms of what they could play the DJs, and they could play a whole B-side, all of them, or a whole
absolutely.
Album.
Yes, they'd have B-side nights or album side weekends. Q102 in Dallas, when I was growing up, Q102 would have an album side weekend, and it was great.
And they took time. You know, when you did an album, you recorded songs that had a storyline, like Tapestry. You know, that's one of the things about Tapestry. There's a through line about womanhood, you know, coming together, you know, I mean, all the things she was going through, you know, it was really different. You know, she was, you know, such a force, Carole King, you know, but she wrote that way. They all wrote, you know what I mean? There were things that they did. And then you sequence it, you know, everything's, you know, sometimes you can't just throw a song in there. That's where they used to do that in the early 60s. You go a couple of hits, you put it on an album, but you throw a bunch of covers that they would do. Excuse my dogs. So yeah, Me Family is, it's now it's out for, it's on rental, and you can buy, rental and buy. It's on all the Apple and all the platforms, Amazon Prime. And, you know, as I tell people, these films are really important that people talk about them, because the more success they have, others will come out and other stories will come out. And Brian, just, you okay? You just froze.
And I saw on Rotten Tomatoes, it gets like 100%.
Yeah, so we're at 100% with the critics and 91% with folks. And if you like it, please, please go on Rotten Tomatoes and tell, you know, give your review. Here's what I tell festivals. If you like a film, please spread the word. It's so important for us filmmakers. Because don't forget, these films are not blockbusters. Hey, I love a blockbuster. I would be thrilled if it was, you know, if it made $2 million. I'd be lucky. They don't make those. This is a music doc. Very difficult. It's not Taylor Swift, God bless her. You know, but I'm hoping that these stories do get around. I said, if you don't like a film, don't tell anybody. That's my motto.
That's right. There you go. Yeah, mum's a word.
If you don't like it, that's...
Zip it up right there.
Zip it up.
And I remember you telling me that you were briefly in an 80s rock and roll music video. Was it a heavy metal video or something?
I had my brief little stint. Well, I used to do a lot of rock videos, but I did have with the Ramones.
Ramones.
I was in that one Ramones video at the end.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Yeah. No, what I always go ahead.
What are some of the other ones that you've done? I mean, the Ramones.
Oh, videos?
Yes.
Oh, God. I've worked on so many. I did In Excess, Chicago. I didn't direct. I was just a grip and lighting.
Okay. That's fine.
One of my favorite music we did, which I still play, is Robbie Neville's. What was Robbie Neville's song? Great video. It won a lot of awards. All right. So at 62, I'm losing my memory.
Hey,
so
that's okay. It's a perfect that's okay. Show. I lose my phone and keys every day. So don't
yes.
You know,
thank
don't
God
feel bad
for
about
trackers.
It.
I should put a tracker on myself so I know where I am.
That's good. Yeah. One day I told a friend of mine yesterday, I was looking all over for my phone, and my wife goes, it's in your hand. So yeah. I mean, I felt so stupid. I mean,
how about when you're wearing glasses? I can't find my glasses. <You're> wearing, I've done that. It's embarrassing.
Yeah, it's not that bad. But you did, talking about the Ramones, was there a funny story related to that that video?
No, it was. Oh, what is that room? I can't remember that name of the title. You see it. It's a
Rock and Roll High School, or was it one of
No, it was after that. It was, I'd have to look it up.
Okay.
But it was what was cool about it, we did it at we lived at this location. So we did a lot of videos like Robbie Neville, that one. We did Lou Rawls, Concrete Blonde, LA Guns, all these kind of different groups at the time in the 80s.
Sure.
But we had a loft that we used to live and shoot at. And this was a funky loft, and the Ramones were at one table sitting down, and they don't move, they just sing the song. But what happens is people come into the frame from around the room. It's a room that was 100 feet, And I watched it recently and went, oh my God, how did we put all those people in the place? Because it comes out to about 30, 40, 50 people in the end running around. Now, what you do is in those days, you would play the song really slow. Okay. So when the vocals are playing like this and they're singing yes. the song like this, everybody else is just walking around at normal speed, you know, normal speed. Well, when you play back, everybody's doing this, but the guys are in sync with the film.
Oh, you know, that's hilarious. Yeah.
It's a pretty cool gimmick and it's one shot.
I'll have to check that out.
Yeah. The videos gave the business, all of us, a chance to experiment. I mean, that was the thing about the 80s, you know, it gave dancers a career because all of a sudden now we have videos with dancing. You know, a lot of dancers, you know, made a career out of it, you know, and, you know, with dancers, it's a very small window, you know, and for us as lighting technicians, there were no rules. You know, it wasn't like you were lighting a scene in a movie. Well, that's not looking right. That doesn't look like it would look. Doesn't matter. This is surreal sometimes.
That's right. You can be a little bit artsy in things.
Very much so. And, you know,
and there's like that one Squeeze video that had looked like a Salvador Dali video.
Oh yeah,
yeah, that was so cool. So yeah. You could do things like that and. Obscure camera angles and lighting and things. That must have been fun.
And, you know, it's funny because I tell these younger kids want to know, you know, how to break in the business. And I said, listen, you have to just try. You guys have a better chance of making a film without any of us helping you because you have an iPhone. And I tell people, especially, you know, these audiences when I speak at, you know, these, you know, conventions or these festivals, or whatever, I said, go interview your parents or your grandparents before they pass on. You don't have to make a documentary about it. Just do it because right. history is behind us, you know, and make, you know, what you're doing today, you're capturing it and you might not need it tomorrow. You know, I'll look at it in a year or 5 years, but believe me, for someone that does this for a living now, I'm looking at stuff I haven't seen in, you know, 20 years and using it. But I would love to hear my grandfather's voice. I don't remember what it was like.
That's
I don't
right.
remember.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. You know, it wasn't until 1980 did we have VHS and sound. Unless you were, you know, really cool and had a Super 8 camera with sound, we didn't have that.
No, yeah. You know? Growing up, I have some 60s movies, but they had no sound. They were the little Super 8, you know, and
yeah.
no sound. So,
you know, there's yeah. My next project that I'm working on is Wolfman Jack.
Oh, wow.
And
wow.
Yeah, and I'm loving this.
Is that a secret now, or can you tell us
no.
hints about that?
Yeah, it's about Wolfman. So I'm telling you, we just started shooting, and I've interviewed Richard Dreyfuss, a couple DJs, Johnny Rivers. And, you know, it's funny how we're of a certain age. We all know Wolfman Jack, and you go, oh, wow, right? You talk to someone that's 35, they go, I'm not sure who that is.
That's right, and, yes.
And that's because Wolfman was a personality of an era. He was so huge. And then Wolfman goes. It wasn't like he had a bunch of films that were left over, you know, that we always saw. You know, he was always constantly in TV shows, but he played himself.
So Midnight Special and things like that, right? Yeah.
And so when I was approached to do the job and I talked to the family, I said, this is what I would love to do. I want to know who Wolfman Jack is, who's Bob Smith. I said, please send me all your videos, home videos, you know, VHS is anything you have.
Sure.
Because I want to see what's behind. I want to see the real Wolfman. And I'm telling you, Brian, it's like being an archaeologist. He's sifting through. I mean, I'm watching tapes that sometimes
that's
like
amazing.
Like, oh, you know, the greatest thing is there's so many. And Wolfman would always have the camera when he had a camera at that time. He would have a camera do, you know, he loved Christmas. And he'd be, you know, going around
right.
the room talking for hours. And he'd go, Mom, what'd you get? And she'd go, I got a clock. Go, oh, that's a beautiful clock. And you go, oh my
that's
God,
priceless. Wow.
But he's, you know, he's just like a great dad, a great son. You know what I mean? He's not, he was so heartwarming. I can't tell you how excited I, there was times when it like, he put a camera down as they're playing Monopoly. You know, I've never played Monopoly and finished a game. Now I have to watch this because he might say something.
That's right. There's some tidbits in there.
Yeah. I mean, there's some beautiful things. I'm telling you, I'm so excited about this. I'm hoping to interview Joe Walsh. I got Burton Cummings in a couple of weeks.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was a real person. That's the thing. And it comes back to family. Just like immediate family was about family. Wrecking Crew is about my father and his family, meaning his guys. Wolfman's about family. He took care of his family. He took care of his folks that worked for him. He had a big, you know, group of people he always took care of. And I love that. You know, it's going to be fun.
Yeah. And being in the radio business, I just love the radio aspect of it where he's, you know, at the X, on the X, you know, that ZZ Top talks about heard it on the X and in different pirate radio.
Yeah. And so for those who don't remember, he was the, you know, he did the Mexican radio station and he was a hustler, man. He figured out ways of making a buck. His son, Todd, said it was great. He goes, there was anything in the house was a trade out. He came up with the commercial, the drapes, the desk, everything was, he was just that guy. He was like us, you know what I mean? Figure out ways of making things work. And that's what I love about him. He was a hustler in a positive way. You know what I mean? A
lovable hustler. Right?
Lovable. Yeah. He would make it work. And one of the things that his son said, he never went bankrupt. There were hard times, but he never let his vendors go. And, you know, it meant so much to him. He was very, you know, proud of what he did. You know, growing up, it was hard growing up as a kid. You know, parents are divorced. So I'm excited about this project.
Yeah, and a lot of people, probably the younger generation doesn't know, he was at pirate radio stations over the border, and they were blowing like million watts, and they were
250,000 watts. They were
unbelievable
all the way across the world at nighttime, and no one, you know, if you don't know, radio 50,000 is I think what we were allowed, right? And
yeah, those are considered flamethrowers right now.
And you know, now it's forget it because it's, you know, it's Sirius and all these other things, but it made a big difference. And you know, he was the first one to play, you know, he was playing black music. You know, he was playing soul, blues, and all this other stuff. And one of his, in his book, he said, I didn't play it because it was cool to play it. You know, it wasn't doing it for a reaction. He says, I was playing because I loved it.
Right.
And it's true. He turned on so many people. So many people he turned on to the music and where it wouldn't get played. You know, and people thought he was black. You know, they thought he was the DJ was black. The greatest scene, and when I did Richard Dreyfuss, I'll give you an example.
Yes.
Richard, you know, that scene in the end where, you know, Richard Dreyfuss is in American Graffiti. And, you know, the whole point is to meet Wolfman Jack. He finally goes into sits down and does his scene with Wolfman Jack and hoping that he's going to, and he goes, I'm not Wolfman. And he goes, oh, okay. And he goes, well, could you pass this on to Wolfman? He says, sure. And, you know, so scene ends. And it's the last day of shooting, by the way, Richard said. And Wolfman turns to Richard, says, hey, thanks a lot. That was the first time I've ever been on camera. And Richard Dreyfuss says, oh, all right. Hey, oh, nice. What's your name? He goes, I'm Wolfman. And Richard Dreyfuss says to me, he goes, oh, my God. I didn't know it was Wolfman.
Oh, that's, you know, hilarious. That's crazy.
He's an actor.
Yeah, right.
And it was, and he goes, and it was just such a sweet moment because, you know, Wolfman's just thrilled to be there. So,
well, Denny, I sure appreciate your time today. We'll wrap it up now. And it just, some great things we talked about today, some interesting stuff. And man, I wish you well with the Wolfman movie. That's going to be great. Thank you so much.
I thank you, Brian. It was good seeing you again.
You too as well. Too. In just a moment, we'll return to music, memories, pop culture, and more on the Medicare Funcast. I want to thank Red River Auto Group for being a sponsor of the Medicare Funcast, Mitch Ward and company here in Central Arkansas. Doing a great job. They have a great selection of vehicles. They will deliver anywhere in the continental USA. Make it really easy on you. Mitch Ward and company are great. Give them a call at 501-381-7807, or their website is redriverauto.com. And MyPillow.com, sandals, pillows, all kinds of bedding and sheets. I have tried really mostly every one of their product, and I really, really love my slippers. Here they are, my slippers. Turn them around here. These are so comfortable. The lining is so warm, especially in the wintertime. Got those for me, and I got these for my wife, Deanne. She loves these. We live in these, especially this time of year. Even in the summertime, I've worn them, and they are just so comfy. And you can get a discount on those by using my promo code KULIS, K-U-L-I-S. And a lot of people don't know this, but there's another website. It's called allamericanmade.com. It's owned by MyPillow, allamericanmade.com. They have auto products, appliances, pet supplies, outdoor items, and all kinds of great stuff. Again, that's allamericanmade.com and mypillow.com. Use promo code KULIS. And of course, with any questions on Medicare, you can call or email me. My company is Affordable Health and Life, 501-307-1396. You can email me at MedicareFunCast@gmail.com. Love to hear from you.
We now return to the Medicare Funcast with Brian Kulis.